So I wanted to share a poem with you to start. It's The Journey by Mary Oliver. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt that old tug at your ankles, "Mend my life," each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the streets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing that you could do, determined to save the only life you could save, your own. It starts as an inclination, kind of in the back of one's mind, that we try to ignore. Mend your own life. Do your part. Help them. Tell your story. The call comes and the temptation is to ignore that incessant ring, ring, ring of its demand. We follow our journey, whether it is planned or just random, and it brings us places we never thought were possible, places where we may have felt uncomfortable or comfortable. And the voices within us cried out, and there was that pull in our minds or in our hearts. Maybe it was or is a sense of discontent that needles. That is how it began for me. I had the best job in the world. Anyone would have wanted it and did. But it wasn't enough for me. I felt called to seek and to search in books and on trips. I would go deeper, striving to uncover a wisdom about this life, about my life. I felt tormented at times about the way things were evolving in this world, about constructs that hold us in place. And I found myself asking why over and over again. Why must people suffer? Why must the planet be in turmoil? Why do so many of us walk by or avert our gaze when there are people in need? Why do we choose a state of complacency and numbness over awareness? Why do we choose not to change and help when we can, when we should? I walked by those in need for years. I helped when it was easy, as writing a check, when it wouldn't take any skin off my nose. But when it required skin in the game, I got busy, held tightly onto my beliefs, told myself that I had done enough, given enough, showed up enough, even though there is never a time when there is enough. Then I entered a cave in southern England, faced my fears, and in facing my fears, I was called to change my life. I left my job, offered up my identity of self to serve. My friends thought I was insane, but I wanted to be a catalyst for change, and to be changed. I wanted to be changed. It was scary then, and at times it still is scary. What is it that compels one to change? What is it that calls us to action? What is it that encourages us to step outside of our routine, to cross over to the other side of the road to help, or to enter into the darkness of our own metaphorical or literal caves? What calls us to help another in need? Archbishop Desmond Tutu endeavored to answer this question. He explains that we have been created for goodness. It is quite wonderful, yes, amazing, he says, that in a hard-headed, cynical world such as our own, those we admire the most, indeed revere, are not as we might have expected. They are not the macho, the aggressive, even the successful. No, amazingly, it is such as Mother Teresa, a Dalai Lama, a Mahatma Gandhi, and a Nelson Mandela. Why do we revere such as these? Why? It is because they are good, and our hearts rejoice and exult in their presence. They make us feel good about being human. And because we, all of us, have been made for goodness, we have been made for laughter, we have been made for gentleness, we have been made for caring, for sharing, for compassion. Could this be true, that we are made for compassion? I have heard it said that there are two kinds of people in the world, givers and takers. The saying goes that takers eat better, but givers sleep better. Eat or sleep, is that the choice that we have to make, or is it deeper than that? Are we called to act in the face of adversity? Jan, love the story. Loved your sharing. In my research for this sermon, I found a study that referred to a concept called the bystander effect, which explained that if one is on their own and observes someone in need, they are more likely to act as an individual rather than if they are in a group of people. People in a group tend to wait for someone else, more qualified, stronger, bolder, to react. Or maybe it is something in our social context that holds us back. Maybe we worry about our own safety or if this person is worthy of our support. Will we make a mistake? Will we hurt them? What if the one in need is a person of color? Does that affect our decision-making process? Imagine the exact scenario that might compel you to help. What would it be? What would call you to stand out and to help? I've been imagining and thinking about this a lot over the last year as we stand as witnesses to the race-based violence that has occurred in this country. I thought a lot about the credibility of race. I thought about the color of my skin being one who was adopted. I don't know. The truth is that race is a human construct, as is all things. It was created to exemplify difference and to support the institution of slavery of Africans in this country. It was created for greed. In an article on the website anthropology.net, Emmanuel Luska contemplates race as a social construct. He writes, "Our daily lives are affected by race, whether we are aware of it or not. We all see the world through a racial lens that colors our world, black, Asian, white, Latin American, minority, or other. How we are seen and how we see others affects various domains of our lives, the lives of others. From the types of jobs we have, the amount of money we make, the kinds of friends we make, the places we live, the foods we eat, the schools we go to, etc. The entire social structure we inhabit is affected by at least one social construct, race. Interestingly, most people in the United States, which consist of people of color, are aware of this, but have not dismantled it. Why is that?" He goes on, "There is nothing absolute or real about social constructions in the same way as there is something absolute and real about rocks, rivers, mountains, and in general, the objects examined by physics. For example, the existence of a mountain is not contingent on a collective acceptance, imposition, or agreement. A mountain will exist regardless of people's thinking, agreeing, or accepting that it does exist. Unlike a mountain, the existence of race requires that people collectively agree and accept that it does exist." France Boas a physicist by training, supports this view of race best in his work, Race, Language, and Culture, where he observes that there is nothing biologically real about race. There's nothing that we have identified as race that exists apart from our collective agreement, acceptance, and a position of its existence. We claim race. My friends, at the most basic scientific level, race is not real. Intelligence based on race is not real. Athletic prowess based on race is not real. Earning potential, commitment to a work ethic based on race is not real. A select group of affluent white folks of European descent created race, and we, on a daily basis, agree to uphold these concepts. We take race as a given scientific fact, like gravity, when it is really just a matter of pigment. By our mere complacency, we agree to maintain the construct of race and the privileges and oppression associated with specific races. Race is not a worldwide phenomenon. It exists within our own minds. Am I the only one who believes this is just absolutely ridiculous? I, for one, can no longer participate in a system of race oppression. I honor all people equally, regardless of difference, and I'm certain that each one of us does as well. I know with my whole heart that we want to be givers. Thus, I would call us to stand up, to act, to endeavor to make our nation a better, more fair place for all. It is unconscionable that so much is inferred about people by how they look. Here is a genetic truth. We all descend from, in unbroken line, on our mother's side, and through the mothers of those mothers, and so on, back until all lines converge on one person, mitochondrial Eve, who lived approximately 100,000 to 200,000 years ago. Even of more interest than that, all humans alive today share a surprisingly recent common ancestor, perhaps even within the last 5,000 years, even all of those born on different continents. Can we say prolific? We are literally all genetically related to one another. How does that change our perception of the other? Is there really such a concept of other, or is it really those relatives we've just not met yet? I'm personally outraged that, or what, has been done to our common descendants in the name of profit and greed. All lives matter. There is no debate about this fact in our Unitarian Universalist community. All lives matter. But there is a lack of understanding and misinformation in our communities and in the country, a torrid history that perpetuates the lies that we created to enslave and oppress. Are we willing to be compliant? Or are we called to speak the truth? I cannot stand by idly while my dark-skinned brothers and sisters continue to be oppressed, imprisoned, and murdered. So it is time that we put our skin into the game, so to speak. Next Sunday, in a small ceremony after worship, we will put up a banner on our lawn that will read in big letters, Black Lives Matter. These are our people. We will probably have to answer questions about if black-skinned lives matter, do they matter more? Is that why you put the sign up? More than red-skinned people or yellow-skinned people or brown-skinned people or white-skinned people? No, of course not, would be our answer. However, people who have dark skin have been and are in the crosshairs of our society for years. And it's time to change that. Truly. I'm called to act and to stand on the side of love, and I know you all are too. I'm called to do whatever I can do to dismantle a system of oppression based on race and to welcome those who have been unjustly segregated into my own larger family. These are our brothers and sisters, our cousins, our aunts, our nieces, our nephews. It is said that we are known by our actions. And if we look at the actions that have been taken with regard to people whose skin is darker than ours, how people of color receive less, are considered less important, or even undesirable when it comes to embracing a neighbor, what does that say about us? Time changes all, and all social constructs should be reviewed and revised. I invite us all to be part of a solution that dismantles a construct that no longer serves humankind. This is your call. What is the right thing to do? You've got to search your heart. It will take commitment. It will take inspiration. It will take courage. I know, because we are all one family, that we all share these traits. Let us begin by realizing the lens that colors our world, that fears that we have about one another and who our system regards and why. Realize the hierarchy that exists in this country: white man, white woman, Asian man, Asian woman, Latino, Latina, Native man, Native woman, black man, black woman. That is the hierarchy. And to this list, add religion: Christian, Jewish, Mormon, Muslim, then wealthy and poor. And one can see how our system becomes complicated and convoluted. My wish is that the American dream could be colorblind. But right now it isn't. The truth is that after all these years, I still feel tormented at times, but about the way things are evolving in this world, about constructs that hold us in place, I find myself asking why. Over and over again, just asking why. Why must people suffer? Why must the planet be in turmoil? Why do so many of us walk by when there are people in need? Why do we choose a state of complacency and numbness over awareness? Why do we choose not to change and help when we can and should? My dear beloved brothers and sisters, because you are. And I've now got a very large family, I realize. It is up to us. Join me. Join me in standing up against the bullies. For this we pray, may it be so. Amen. Please rise in body and our spirit for our hymn number 1024 in the teal hymnal. It is called When the Spirit Says Do. And Deborah's asked me to say to you, we're going to sing 4 verses, and they will include the words do, sing, dance, and we will end with shout. So do, sing, dance, and shout.